Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 1st, 2021. Well, many little kids have ridden on bicycles, starting on tricycles. My younger brother would ride around and around the backyard and then aim himself at the garbage cans to stop. And that is a true rite of childhood. Everyone rode a bike. But some guys ride their bikes more. Some guys like it more than most people. And we have the good fortune to speak to someone today who rode his bike from the Seaport District in Boston all the way to Oregon, across the United States. And he did it to publicize climate issues, to learn about climate issues, to tell about climate issues. And if you've ever thought of riding your bike to the supermarket, you know the kinds of challenges there are pedaling cross country. And it's a remarkable story. So we are thrilled to be joined by Alan Wright, who is an urban bicyclist and a member of many Boston area bicycling groups, not the least of which being Rozzy Bikes. Alan, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, Ted. I'm doing very well. Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a fan of...
My little story about you biking across America, is it as sort of evocative as the Simon and Garfunkel song, or riding to look for America? Or tell me, why did you do it? Why did you decide to bike across America?
I think my Twitter handle might say it the best. It's at Alan, A-L-A-N, bike, climate, three words. So bicycling across America has been a bucket list item of mine since I was a teenager, when on my first bike ride, which was across the state of Wisconsin with a youth group. I'm retired 2 years, and I've now got the time and resources to do it. I still have the good health, knock on wood.
Yeah.
And I've been a proponent of bicycling as a solution to our transportation problem. My entire life, I've been active in one way or another promoting bicycling, and I'm deeply concerned. I'm frightened, freaked out, if you will, about the pace of climate change. I understand the science, and I can look forward to what's going to happen. And I'm terrified for not myself, but for my son and the children that are here now and coming before us. And I think bicycling is one solution to our carbon dioxide problem. So
tell me,
that's what I did.
Tell me what, so before we talk about the ups and downs of literally biking across the country, do you have a sort of pithy, what's the essence of the bicycle as a sort of solution for, I don't know, climate, health, urban design? I mean, why does it fit? Why do you see it fitting in a lot of ways of being a solution?
So the average car trip in the United States is something like 2.5 to 3 miles. My neighbor, who lives 3 blocks from our local grocery store, which he shops at, drives his car there. Why? Well, maybe he's bringing too many groceries back to carry by hand. Well, ride a bicycle. You get some exercise, you're outside, and you can load your bicycle up with as much weight and groceries as you want. Instead of turning on the engine of a gasoline-burning car and spewing CO2 in the atmosphere. Prior to the introduction of the automobile in the world, particularly in the United States, people walked and rode bicycles and rode the trolley to do the daily tasks of life. We can still do that. And not only that, but we're in the midst of a revolution that isn't really understood. It's not publicized very much, but it's called electric bicycles. Electric bicycles solve a whole host of problems. You got a couple of kids you got to take to school, you can put them on the back of your electric cargo bike. You need to pick up all the groceries to feed the family, you can fill up those big cargo bags on the back of your electric bicycle. You got hills to climb on your way to work or running errands? Well, guess what? The electric bicycle solves that hill problem. People are adopting electric bikes left and right, all over this country and all over the world. You know, we hear a lot of talk about electric cars. Forget electric cars. Electric bikes are where it's at.
Okay. We've been having a series on a series of podcasts concerning the extraction of lithium and the environmental impact of that. And there was some part of that said, you know, the Ford F-150 truck, the Ford F-150 electric truck, if you took that battery, it would power something like 100 e-bikes, right?
Yeah.
Fair use of lithium, you know, the electric bike is much more, I don't know, what's the right word, democratic.
I have seen estimates of it being much higher than that. And let's, for example, take the electric Hummer, which is now on the market. Those batteries would probably power 1,000 electric bicycles.
Yeah. Well, so tell me this. You decided you were going to pedal across the country. This is a lifelong dream. You had the experience. You said you had done it in high school. You probably have done a fair amount of on-road adventure biking. When you set off, what did you get on the Mass Pike and pedal west? I mean, how did you find your way? Did you have what do you do?
Very good question. And it's an interesting thing because it's a phenomena that's in transition right now. There is a 40 plus year old organization called Adventure Cycling out of Missoula, Montana, that has been building routes across the country now for 40 years, done a remarkable job. You can buy their maps, you can download their GPS routing and follow their routes if you want. But more and more people are using apps like Ride with GPS or Komoot or it's easy to do to plot out. So what I did was I set my starting point Boston and my end point, which was essentially Oregon, the seaside, but I have family in Portland. And then I said, well, what do I want to do in between? Well, I want to visit my sister in Kalamazoo, the hometown I grew up in, Illinois, friend in St. Louis, relatives in Kansas. Okay, so I got those points. And then I plugged in the adventure cycling routes and said, okay, well, I can use their maps to do this much. But then I did something even greater. There is a national organization called Rails to Trails, which has been behind the movement of converting old abandoned railroads to bike, pedestrian, equestrian routes. Mm-hmm. And you can download their app and find all of the rail trails in the United States. And let me tell you, there are thousands of them. There are trails like, well, for example, the Erie Canal Trail that runs from Albany to Buffalo, which is 270 miles long, or the Katy Trail, which runs from St. Louis to Kansas City, which is 230 miles long.
Yeah, a continuous bike trail is 200 miles long.
So I did 4,200 miles of bicycling across the United States, and nearly 2,000 of those miles were on bike trails.
Wow. So let me, I'm still stuck on the idea of you're sitting in Columbus Park or whatever it is in downtown Boston or Seaport District. How do you find your way out? Do you get on like Route 20 and then keep pedaling? Is that where it would have put you, or did you find it? I know there were routes that, you know, sort of bike routes that get out of Boston, but just even that little microcosm of your trip.
Really good question, because you don't want to be on Route 9 biking to Worcester. Right. That's a hellhole experience. But you could get on parts of Route 20, but even better, you could get on side roads, whether you're in a small town or you're, you know, someplace in rural Worcester County. Mm-hmm. So there are these really good apps. The best one that I use is a Komoot, which is a German app that's designed around bicycle touring. And you put in your starting point and your destination point, and it will design a route that gets you on the nicest, least trafficked roads possible. It'll put you out on dirt, on gravel, on county asphalt roads. And it's easy to adjust. If you find some road was a bad selection and you look up in, the GPS mapping software, you know, for an alternative road, you can easily adjust it.
Interesting.
Yeah. It used to be that when people were doing this kind of touring, they would take paper maps and they would spend days studying them, trying to figure out the best routes, and they would often get lost. It was an adventure. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to do these days.
Did you plan each day? I mean, did you get up in the morning and say, I want to go 70 miles. That puts me at about this town. And let me put that into my app.
I did. Yes, I did.
Interesting.
Where I didn't already have a route from adventure cycling, that's what I did. I would go into this Komoot app and I'd put my starting point, end point, and let it design the route. And then I would study the route and adjust it. And I would do it the day beforehand. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of bike did you have? It must have been a sturdy kind of mountain bike with knobby tires or something?
Nah. I had a touring bike. Mm-hmm. So a touring bike has got a particular geometry to it that makes it more stable when you're carrying a lot of weight, mm-hmm. which is what happens when you're doing a self-supported ride. I had tires that were about an inch and a half wide with a reasonably aggressive tread, but not mountain bike tread, mountain bike treads create a lot of road friction. So you're working very hard.
For the people who may not be bikers, right? The mountain bike treads are that sort of things that you see that the kids have on their bikes, right? All these knobs, right? And the touring bike is kind of a classic looking bike, and I think the difference between these bikes is essentially the vertical angle of the seat, sort of how far forward and how far back that is. It allows you to relax a little bit as you're pedaling. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's reasonably fair. I would comment two things about that. Those knobby tires that you see in the kids' bikes, those are a major reason that kids give up bicycling. Those tires are completely useless. It's like selling an SUV. Oh, really? We'll sell them the heaviest bike with all this spring suspension and big tires. Well, nobody likes riding that because it takes too much work to get around the city.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
So I've got this picture now that you wake up in the morning. You have an idea where you're going, of course, right? But each morning you sort of confirm it on your app, and then you take off. Were you completely by yourself? Was there a support car? Was there somebody you could call? Did you have? Or were you just out there on your own?
Completely by myself, out there on my own. Wow. I did end up riding with three other people through Western Nebraska, South Dakota, and through Wyoming to Yellowstone. And then one guy and I rode up into Montana together. But otherwise, I was riding by myself.
But and how did you meet them? Oh, go ahead. Continue.
So here's the thing, Ted, is that what is remarkably different about bicycling across America is that you were traveling at a human speed. In other words, you're traveling slowly. And so you get to see things and you get to meet people. For example, I had three people at different moments stop their cars in the middle of the highway, roll down their windows, and ask me if I needed anything, you know, like a water bottle. Really? And I would bicycle along and someone's sitting out in their front porch and they wave at me and they call out a question and I stop and have a conversation with them. Or there's one of those road historical markers that you flash by in your car and you don't have the time or the inclination to turn the car around and go read the darn thing. I would stop at those things because I'd see them as I'm coming up at 10 miles an hour and I'd read them.
Interesting. So that you're saying is that, so I mean, that sends us down, there's so many aspects of this that are interesting. That sends down a different path. In a climate constrained world, a carbon constrained world, right? Tourism and people having adventures is going to change because air flight is going to be expensive. I mean, do you see yourself as a leader, a pioneer of a new kind of tourism that you adopt?
Very good question. So people have been doing bicycle touring ever since bicycles were invented. So I'm not alone. There's more and more people doing it, particularly young people, because they recognize that there's a better way to travel that's more in touch with ecology, with how we live, with our natural rhythms. And there was also quite a few baby boomers who were doing at least short trips, maybe not so many across the country, but mm-hmm. but yeah, that's happening more and more. I lost my train of thought.
So let me put you on a different one. I'm just intrigued with the mechanics of getting. You wake up in the morning. You say, "I want to get to a certain town." You look on your app. You head out. What happened? Is there somebody there that you know is going to take you in? Have you called ahead? Are if you don't get there, do you find yourself in the middle of a cornfield, sleeping out on your own? I mean, how did that? And were there any adventures where things happened that you said, "Oh man, now I'm on my own. Got to figure out how to manage this thing I didn't expect."
Really good questions, and I will answer them right now. But I want to come back to the answer about how climate change is affecting tourism, or will in the future. It's affecting it now. So it's very different east of the Mississippi versus west of the Mississippi. Mississippi just being a really good dividing line. The dividing line is really sort of in the middle of Kansas, Nebraska, if you will. But you don't really have to plan very much or worry about resources when you're on the east side of the Mississippi, because you're only 5 miles from a little town or 2 miles from the next convenience store. It's just, you know, you set your goal. I'm going to do 75 miles today. I want to get to this town because I know there's a KOA campground outside that town or something, and you just do it. As you get further out west, then you have to be much more careful about planning, because the population density is so much lower that the distance, the space between resources, you know, that convenience store where you need to refill your water bottle, that could be 50 miles on a very hot, dry day. So you really have to plan those things a little bit better. I camped in commercial campgrounds. I camped in state parks. I camped along the locks on the Erie Canal. I stayed in motels when it was too hot. I wanted a bed, I wanted a better shower, or it was raining buckets or whatever. Mm-hmm. I stayed with some family and friends along the way, but I also used what's called warm showers. It's an international group of bicyclists who act as hosts when they're not on bicycle trips. And when they're on a bicycle tour, they go to this little app and they find a warm showers host in whatever town that they're aiming for at the end of the day. And they may be camping out in the backyard, or they may be in a guest bed. They may get a meal, they may not, but they're guaranteed a warm shower. So I did that 5 times. And that's another thing that makes bicycling so wonderful, is because you're constantly having these contacts, these adventures with people that you wouldn't meet otherwise if you're driving and staying in Motel 6.
I see. I mean, I'm ready to get my bike out now. So tell me.
Can I go?
Yeah,
so
please do.
When I lost my train of thought, you asked the question as, you know, is climate change changing tourism? And the absolute answer is yes, and it's going to change dramatically. The West is particularly dependent upon tourism. Montana, Colorado, Wyoming, you know, people going to Yellowstone, the Oregon coast, Washington, and so on. All of those heat waves and the fires and the very poor air quality because of the smoke is markedly hampering. For example, the last campground I was in the coastal hills of Oregon, the host of that state park campground told me that the stream, the little river that ran past, that the state had forbidden fishing in the rivers in Oregon. Why? because the water temperature was 72 degrees and fish are endangered when the water gets above 70 degrees. So they don't want healthy fish removed from the streams.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw one of the tweets or messages I saw as you were biking along, because I, dear listener, I will admit I was following Alan as he tweeted out his progress. You encountered the wildfires and had to wear one of those KN95 masks as you cranked along just because of the air quality. This is out in the Great American West. Tell me that story.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we were coming up, I was riding with a millennial 35-year-old guy from Houston. As we were coming up into Western Oregon, Western Montana, we were heading to Missoula, and we were going to be going over some passes that were about 5,000 or 6,000 feet and ending up in valleys that were a little bit higher than we were. But the problem was, when we looked at the fire data that's available on federal government website, was that we saw that there were fires sprinkled all around in the mountains that our route was going to pass through. And the air quality was measuring 140, 150, 160. So we made the decision that we would head south. Instead of north toward Missoula, we would head south over towards Boise, Idaho. Well, we got 30 miles into that ride after having gone up into a pass, and we come into this tiny little, it's hard to call it a town, Grant, Montana. People go look at it on Google Earth. You'll be perplexed that it has a name. And when we went into the little restaurant motel bar that was there and ordered some lunch, and we asked the chef, she did everything, if we go over the next pass into the next valley, how bad is the air quality going to be? She said, don't do it. This in the morning, she had been called to go pick up a man who was hiking the Continental Divide Trail, who had ever been overcome with smoke inhalation. She had to rescue him and bring him back to this little motel that she was running. Wow. And he was in the next room sleeping it off. So we abandoned the plan to go down towards Boise. And in part, we did that because we knew how big the fire in Southern Oregon was that was blowing smoke up. We couldn't go over the passes that would take us up to Missoula. So guess what we did? This goes back to a question you asked earlier. We rode on Interstate 15 to Butte, Montana.
Really? Really?
It's legal to ride a bicycle on the interstate in Montana. And it's actually not so bad. There's not an enormous amount of traffic. The shoulders are very wide. So mm-hmm. other than the noise, it's doable. But the smoke was so bad that we had to wear masks to keep our throats from being so irritated that it was hard to breathe.
Wow.
So think about that. Think about that in terms of what impact it will have in tourism in the great Northwest and West. It's people are going to be afraid to go, which is probably a good thing, because the so much of the tourism out there in the West is people driving those monster RVs and those big motorhomes, and they're hauling cars behind them. They're putting out so much CO2. It's just extraordinary.
So tell me, what you went on this clearly adventure of a lifetime kind of a thing, because it's something you wanted to do. There was a climate context to it. Did you go out of your way to discuss climate issues with people? Was there pushback? Did people want to hear about it? Did they not want to hear about it? What was your experience in that aspect of this journey?
Good question. So when I left, I had signs on the side of my panniers that hold my gear, my saddlebags, if you will, that said, have you experienced climate change? I was trying to go at this in a neutral way, right? And nobody, absolutely nobody wanted to take up the conversation. One guy did yell at me in New York State, outside of Buffalo. He yelled and said, yeah, I'm experiencing climate change. It's been getting colder out here. Well, yeah, guess what? The polar vortex has been making it colder up in the Northeast. I did attempt to have conversations with people. What I universally discovered is that no one in this country, no one wants to talk about anything that is politically related. And of course, mm-hmm. unfortunately, climate change is not politics. It's science, right? But it's been politicized by the vested interests, the fossil fuel interests. And so people didn't want to talk about it. Right. So I ended up taking the signs off.
Yeah, I can see that certainly I would be leery of talking to a stranger about something that I considered a politically charged thing, right?
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate that things have become that politicized, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Gosh. Well, look, I think it's a fascinating discussion. I mean, there's so much more to discuss, but this is wonderful. What I will do now is we're going to put up some links to some of the stuff we talked about. I'm going to put up your Twitter handle, Alan Bike Climate. I'm going to find the Warm Showers website and put that up, and maybe I'll find the Google location of Grant, Montana, and put that up as well, just so people can get a context for this fascinating thing you did.
And do one more link, if you would, which is to Trail Link. It's the app that is produced by Rails to Trails. It's called Trail Link, all one word, mm-hmm. two L's. And it gives the location of every bicycle trail in the country.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's great. We'll put up that link, those links on the blog. It's the show notes for the show. That'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have a question or an idea about what shows we ought to be doing, send us an email to the email podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what's good, what's bad, and what we ought to be talking about. Of course, you're listening to the show on your smartphone, probably using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask your friends to listen to the show on their smartphone using their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. And so we'll close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. So we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that recognizes the inequities of disadvantaged communities. If we do all that, we will safeguard our collective future. So, Alan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Ted. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.